When I'm answering or reflecting on, let's not say answer, when I'm reflecting on the question, I would like you also to notice if you are relieved or if you're disappointed if it is not your question. If it is not your question, are you relieved or are you disappointed? Are you feeling chosen or pleased not to be chosen? Or what's going on with you as one question after another is reflected upon, but perhaps it isn't your question? So I'd like you just to notice that and maybe make a little note about it. I would also like you to notice whether you felt freer to ask a question in this form, writing it down, than you might have done if I just asked you to stand and give a question. And the other side of that is whether you put your name to the question. I may or may not read out a name, whether you put it there or not, because I think there is a certain amount of freedom, because sometimes we are a little bit uneasy about asking our question and revealing that much of ourselves, which is why I have grown this custom of having the questions in the basket. But I want you to pay attention to that. I want you to pay attention to how you feel about how you ask the question. There's a teacher who's, I think, probably more or less my age, called Gangaji. And her entire sessions, somebody asks a question, or several people ask a question, and then she brings someone up the front, and her entire teaching session is a dialogue around that question with the student, which in one way is a wonderful way to teach because you don't have to do any preparation. But it also perhaps slightly limits the canvas on which you're teaching. And so I like to do it a little bit differently. I like to feel that I'm bringing subjects and then topics and then themes, and then read your faces so that I know more about what you're needing right here in this very moment, and more than one of you, many more, as many of you as I can include. But I also notice that when you write a question, particularly at this stage in the retreat, when you are much more tuned to the collective than when you arrived. You are now much more tuned to the collective. You will always have asked your question on behalf of others. So when you go to dinner, for example, this evening, you could most usefully discuss which of the questions really resonated with you, even more than which of my responses. You would be very supportive of one another in reflecting over dinner about the questions, so that others can know that you're also sharing something about the questions. You know, I wrote a whole book on Rainer Maria Rilke, and one of the more philosophical lines from Rilke that people tend to remember is this marvelous advice that he wrote in a letter to a younger poet, and the letters were put together, and it's one of his most famous books. It's called Letters to a Young Poet. Rilke himself was a young poet when he wrote it, but the other poet was even younger. And one of the pieces of advice that he gave was, live into the questions. Know what your questions are, but don't be too quick to find answers, because that's a kind of shutting of the door. Whereas a question is the opening of a door. A question actually is the stepping onto a threshold of greater knowing. And that is what life is offering us. And another word that Rilke uses a lot is unfolding. So in a sense, rather than rushing with our anxiety to know what the answer is, which is always going to be very partial, because it's only what we have today. It's not what you might need tomorrow or have tomorrow. That we embrace the sense that with our big questions, and even our little questions are part of our big questions, what we're actually doing is unfolding and welcoming greater insight, more subtle insight, more heartfelt insight into our lives in order that we can live more lovingly. So in a sense, I've answered all the questions now. It's only 10 to 5. We could all go home early and eat ice cream. All right. Dear Stephanie, please can you explain what the four yogas are about and how, where we can find out more about them? Thank you. Well, the four yogas, the four practices of union that I have already spoken about, are mentioned in the Hindu tradition in a very explicit and very supportive way, and I think quite particularly in the Bhagavad Gita, and I'm just trying to remember if I have written most about them in Seeking the Sacred. I've certainly taught about them most often. So I'll go through them fairly fast and unjustly, but I also want to remind you that in our time, with our opportunities and with our much longer life expectations than people would have had at that time, actually the historical Buddha himself lived for a very long time, but generally speaking, people would have lived to be in their late 30s or early 40s. So, you know, if you followed one path rigorously, you were doing awfully well. But, and don't think of them either as different paths. Actually, Hilary spoke about how relieved she was to find there were different paths to God, but actually there's only one path, and it's just named differently and experience differently, but there is only one path. It's the path of love. But even if we don't follow that path, there is only one path. Yeah. All paths lead. So, there is Jnana Yoga. Let me just start with that one, because that's perhaps the least familiar. It's the path of study. It's the path, in a way, of earnestness. Earnestness gets such a bad rap, doesn't it? But it means actually taking this seriously and valuing it enough to give your time to it. And that's what you have done on this retreat. You have followed the path of Jnana. And I really applaud you for it, because it could be so much easier to spend your Easter putting your feet up and watching the telly. Oh, but you wouldn't have had any ecstasy or bliss or joy or insight. So I think Jnana Yoga is a very, very rewarding path. It's the path of spiritual study, but it's also the path of understanding our humanness. And we study that in such different ways. It's not all about book study. It's also about the study, for example, of the human condition, which you're doing, all of you, in different ways. I often tell the story about K.D. Lang, the Canadian singer, who was very, very popular some years ago. And she was interviewed on television in Australia, and somebody asked her what she read, because she's quite a poet and has written beautiful songs and is definitely a poet. And she said, "Oh, I read the landscape." And Hazrat Inayat Khan also says that this nature is our most sacred book. So Jnana is not just about books, it's about the book, which is also the physical universe, and all its creatures, including ourselves. So, and then there's Bhakti Yoga, which I have spoken about, which is the path of devotion. And actually, there's a very nice aspect of self-sacrifice in this. Devotion also means the discipline that you will devote yourself to something greater than your own self-interest. I like that. I like that very much. And I think it's very, very rewarding that we don't constantly give ourselves a choice as to what we will value. But in giving ourselves clarity about what we value, we are already making choices. Yeah? And then there's karma. And then there's karma yoga. I notice that there's no phones here recording this, but you're most welcome. And then there's karma yoga, which is very familiar to those of us who have had a Christian formation. It's the path of service. And sometimes we can just wear ourselves out being Martha. And remember that Jesus praised Mary for her listening, for her bhakti, for her jnana. He didn't in any way denigrate Martha for her karma yoga, the yoga of service, the yoga of seva. Not at all denigrating, but saying there is also a time for listening and reflection as well as giving service. And in my years of giving many retreats in Catholic organizations, in Catholic schools, with women religious, nuns, in Catholic organizations. And I want to say to you that I have had infinitely more invitations as an interfaith teacher from Catholic organizations than within the Christian world from non-Catholic organizations or from the Jewish world. That there is an openness to this in the Catholic world that I'm immensely exhilarated by. But there is a lot of uncertainty about the extent to which one is even entitled to spend time on one's own spiritual development if it seems to be at the cost of service to others. But actually what we're talking about is the yin and the yang. That we must feed ourselves also in order to give fruitfully. For example, valuing our times of withdrawal from service to others, such as a retreat, such as your meditation, such as your contemplation. And actually, I think for many women religious, since they no longer live in convents, with the time ordained, as it were, for reflection, some of that has been lost, and a lot of Martha has overtaken. Martha and Mary are archetypes that belong to all of us, whatever our gender. And sometimes it can seem more entertaining to be a Martha, not only more obviously action-oriented, but even more entertaining. Sometimes to withdraw, the rewards are more subtle. And we can be used to high action rewards living in this world that we do. We can be used to needing a high level of stimulation and to move into more subtle zones takes a real choice and a real valuing. It's the same as actually listening to a piece of music rather than just having it at the background while we do four or five other things and then pat ourselves on the back for our multitasking. And then the fourth of them, of course, is Raja Yoga. Which is the time we dedicate to our conscious union with God. And actually, once we begin to practice Raja Yoga, which isn't necessarily quite the same as Raja Yoga that the Brahma Kumaris teach, but the Brahma Kumaris teach a most beautiful Raja Yoga. But when we learn this, we also gradually learn that we can dedicate absolutely everything we do. We can dedicate it. And actually the Buddhists themselves, often at the beginning of a Buddhist teaching, they will dedicate the merit of whatever is generated for the for the benefit of all beings. So this act of dedication crosses theistic and less theistic. I absolutely refuse to call Buddhism a not theistic religion because it's just a matter of definitions. Thank you for that question. Is that clear for all? This is about dealing with conflict around us or towards us. The person hasn't mentioned within us. But I think we can assume that conflict also is within us. When we can embrace the source in ourselves, we can learn from it and heal through it. But until then, how do we cope when we are being open-hearted in our life and get flawed with anger that is directed at us? That is a very, very good question. And the answer, of course, which is not an answer, it's simply a reflection. It depends very much on the necessity to be in some kind of physical cooperation with that person. There are situations, both domestic and in workplaces and in community settings, where we do have to experience, or where it is very difficult to avoid experiencing other people's anger. I'm leaving aside our own anger for the moment, but I will return to it. So please remind me if I don't. The one thing that I believe we do not have to do is make ourselves available to be a dumping ground for other people's unexplored, unmastered rage. When we can't avoid some explosion coming in our direction, and when we can't avoid negative projections onto us, we have to take care of ourselves. Because we can't take care of that other person doing something about the resentment or the bitterness or the feelings of entitlement or even pleasure that they may be getting from their rage. So, how do we take care of ourselves? We take care of it in a number of ways. If we are lucky, if we are conscious enough and strong enough, and if we are supported well enough inwardly, if we are supported well enough inwardly, we might speak to that person and say something really honest, like, when you speak to me in that tone of voice, when you say things to me like that, I find it very, very difficult. How can we deal with this? And you would say this, ideally, sitting alongside this person, how can we deal with this? In other words, you avoid blaming, you avoid making yourself a victim, and actually, in some ways, you avoid even making the other person the aggressor. You see it as a shared problem. This does not always work. But it is the most respectful thing that you can do. And out of respect for yourself, and out of respect for your interbeing with all your brothers and sisters, some of whom are expressing what you might choose not to express, but you also know, this is the most respectful thing you can do. And even if it doesn't work once, or 10 times, it might work on the 11th. Generally speaking, if the person is very heated, it does not work to defend yourself. Generally speaking, you have to defend yourself, but not defensively. Is that clear? Generally speaking, you need somehow to disengage. You need to have, and if you have a situation like this in your life, you need to rehearse it. You need to say something like, I'm really sorry you feel like that because I see it differently, but maybe this isn't the time. And in doing that, you are creating a boundary. Sometimes this is quite inflaming. And sometimes you simply need to say, I would really ask you if we could talk about this later. This requires great possession of mind. Because what actually happens, and what happens particularly in intimate relationships, is that a certain dance is set up that is not a dance of life. It's a dance of death. You say this and I say that and you say this and I find myself completely unable not to say that. So you need to rehearse this in the quietness of your own mind. That when this is said, that will not be said. You need to take it to your journal. You need to manage your response when you cannot manage the provocation. And actually, the same is could be said for your own anger arising. I am with Thich Nhat Hanh on this. Thich Nhat Hanh's name is spelled T-H-I-C-H-N-H-A-T-H-A-N-H. And he has a whole book on anger. Huge harm has been done by my psychotherapeutic profession that we should all become experts in anger. Actually, what we need to do is become masters of our emotions. That is, we look closely at what is making us angry. Sometimes it's an injustice, and then we ask ourselves, what am I going to do about this? But from a place of compassion, not just because I am so fired up. Let the firing up be like the firing up of a motor. the firing up of an engine. Let it be a marvelous catalyst for action, but let me not act out of anger, because my wisdom will be diminished. I think that's enough. Is that enough? But Thich Nhat Hanh's two books, Peace is Every Step, and also his book Anger. And actually, what am I saying? I have written a whole section called Transform Your Aggression in the Universal Heart. This is a topic I feel very, very strongly about. I grew up with an angry father. And I could tell you 20 reasons why my, you know, father or anyone, you know, there's always reasons to justify the angry person's anger. But all I would say is that the more you practice being angry, the more you find to be angry about. In the same way that the more you find to rejoice and praise, the more you will find to rejoice and praise. And one last thing too. If you are a very passionate person, and I hope you are, if you are a person who has found it easy to be angry, then you have a lot of passion in you. And this passion can be put to far greater benefit and reward. Take up singing, and not just singing. Take up gospel singing or opera singing, or take up the most vigorous forms of yoga, or take up really wild Spanish dancing. You know, use your body, use your passions. Don't misuse. It's so harmful. It is so hurtful. And you know, if there are parts of your life in which you're receiving that, grow the other parts of your life. Please do. Because it is so hard. A sanctuary of love question. Approaching difficult people with an attitude of good humor. I learned something lovely in my early psychosynthesis training. Because sometimes the difficult person we have to approach is ourselves, isn't it? In Seeking the Sacred. Actually, those of you who've never read Seeking the Sacred, when you leave this retreat and you read Seeking the Sacred, or even if you have already read it, you'll enjoy it so much, because these little stories from people that you now know, and this one wonderful story from Donna about Mrs. Fricker. Very difficult person. But anyway, quite often it is ourselves. What I learnt from psychosynthesis, and, you know, I have forgotten this at least 10,000 times and only remembered it on the 10,001 time, but always worthwhile, which is that when we know we need to have a difficult conversation, first of all, because that's what is really being asked here, a difficult person really means, am I going to have a difficult conversation? So the really useful thing is to ask, for whose sake am I having this conversation? For whose sake am I not needing and wanting this conversation? The other thing is really, to spend a lot of time, could even be a couple of lifetimes, meditating on the wholeness of that person. and seeing them entirely well. Seeing the self, seeing the soul. Seeing the all, knowing who that person is. They have difficulties. Maybe they give quite a lot of difficulties. They are more than their difficulties, as you are. And if the person is very, very difficult and causes you a lot of anguish, I would be very... I would feel quite entitled and not defensive about limiting the time that I spent with that person, if that's possible. If they are a person who, for example, has made it their life work to say very, very unkind things about other people, I would actually ask them to stop. And I would also, if they are unable to stop, as often as possible, take someone else with me. And actually, though, we need to learn something also from that situation that I've just described. What we need to learn from that situation, and I think I wrote a lot about this in Universal Heart 2 as well as in Choosing Happiness, what we really need to notice is that our thoughts radiate way beyond our skull. They create an atmosphere. So we also need to ask ourselves, what's the atmosphere that we're creating before we open our mouths? And it's not our sorrow that creates a difficult atmosphere. It's not our genuine griefs. It's our bitterness. It's our criticisms. It's our cynicism. It's our bigotry. It's our rage. It's our resentment. Yeah? Creates very harsh atmosphere. I write a lot about passive aggression in Universal Heart. Healing is not getting what you want. Healing is being fine with not getting what you want, isn't it? And realizing that what you want may be just part of a very long story. And actually, wouldn't it be a bit alarming always to get what you want, given how limited our wants are? Sometimes we get so much more than we want. This person also writes, the floor is the door for the greater knowing. I think she's reminding herself that we enter the door of greater knowing often through what causes us difficulties and forces us to reconsider. Oh, what is there to learn from the story of Adam and Eve? Well, I don't think that we should learn only that everybody should be heterosexual. Or that there actually was a Mr. Adam and a Mrs. Eve. I think what we can... First of all, there's another part to this question. I think what we can learn is that our longing for companionship. I think we can learn our longing for companionship, which is a very real longing. But I think we also need to learn from this story. Forget the snake, forget the apple for a moment. But do hold in mind the tree of knowledge. I think what we also learn from this is that we are all subject We are all vulnerable to believing that we are fundamentally incomplete and that someone else must complete us. When I was a very, very, very young woman, only 40. Who was it who just turned 40? Yes. I wrote a book called Intimacy and Solitude. And it took 6 years, as I've already mentioned. And then some years later, quite recently really, relatively speaking, I revised it. But I didn't actually have to revise much. I revised some of what I wrote about gender. But I wrote there, and I'm still learning this, that in order to love with fewer conditions, and in order to love less demandingly, and in order really to accept the otherness of the person, we need to develop an understanding of who we are. And we need to give up notions of completion, because after all, we are continuously unfolding. Our relationships become very vulnerable when we demand more of the other person than we are asking of ourselves. When we ask the other person, for example, to find us totally lovable, but we are living in a relationship with ourselves which is highly critical, undermining, and even hostile, and we're asking that other person to compensate for our poor opinion of ourselves, we set them up to fail. And then we are outraged. And they will fail, because it is very likely that they have set us up also to compensate for our lack of love of self. And when you see two beautiful people who are somehow able to be kind, and yes, of course, there is sometimes when they will fall, but they are rising again, and they are grounding, they are drawing up from the earth of kindness. It is such a pleasure to be in their company, because not only are they developing as a couple, they are also developing as individuals capable of giving love. And in those relationships, they are generally capable of giving love much more widely than just to their Adam or to their Eve. I hope that's a surprising answer to what is there to learn from the story of Adam and Eve, because it is a story that belongs to all of us, whether we are Adam or whether we are Eve, and that we really do want to have something from the tree of knowledge. But where I think the story goes terribly wrong is not about their banishment from the Garden of Eden, but that this is given to us as though this was a terrible thing. But in fact, as we've learned over and over and over again, during the time of this retreat, when we are banished from that place of complete innocence where we think all our questions have been answered, because you are so gorgeous and I will never want anything else but to be in your company and play my harp. And when you've got over that, and Well, some people, of course, never get over it, and they're perhaps very lucky too. But when you get over it and you're out in the paddock tilling the ground so that you can plant a little apple tree, you discover actually what you learn from all of that, not just from the apple, but from the tilling of the ground. Oh, somebody wanted to ask about original sin, but my opinion on that is rather well known. And there's even self-love CD, I don't know if there's any left, where I, you know, broadcast on Radio National my views about original sin. Actually, I've reminded you, you're not born in a state of sin. Your true nature is love. I could even say, I believe that. As cautious as I am about, I believe, but I'm really confident. Anybody who spent a lot of time with children could hardly say, born in original sin, in the need of a priest to wash it away. You know, in need of the atonement, no. We celebrate life today. We celebrate life. Actually, there's a fantastic passage from the Psalms, which is in Heaven on Earth. You are gods, all of you, children of the Most High. You are gods, all of you, children of the Most High. Pretty good. Yeah, imagine if they taught that a bit more rigorously in Sunday schools. Yeah. Tell us about an experience that was difficult and how you overcame it. Oh, you have to read it in the books. Too exhausting to remember it again. There have been so many. But you know now how I overcame it. I lived through it. I struggled to learn from it. It's. What's the plural of it? I'm still learning. I'm learning every day. When Donna and I drove back today from our beautiful service, we sat and we had a conversation between two friends who've known each other for a very long time and trust one another utterly. And I learnt something of such value today from Donna. So that's also how I overcome things. I honour my friendships. We learn from one another, don't we? We can't do all the learning by ourselves. You know, the friendships of the writers whom I've studied, the friendship of the friends, you know, I'm privileged to call my friend. Actually, I have learned a lot also from the people that I am no longer close to, but once were, you know. I bow to them all. I truly bow to them. Enough to say, I couldn't have written my books if everything had gone to plan. Could I? I couldn't have written my books if everything had gone to plan, from littlest child to old age. Could you clarify the difference between happiness and joy? Look, in a way, it's a matter of experience and doesn't even matter. We can have quiet happiness. There's something about joy. So if, for example, we sang, joyful, joyful, we adore thee, it wouldn't be quite the same if we sang, happy, happy. And yet, happiness is also beautiful. There's a sort of vibrational difference to it, if I can be a little new agey for a moment. And why can't I be? I'm sitting in the chair. We are sometimes a little reluctant to invite joy into our hearts. We're sometimes a little parsimonious with joy, a little miserly with joy. And yet, you know, it's really joy that we're seeking. But when we pray, may they be well and happy, this is very profound too, because the happiness that we want for people is a certain degree of contentment, a not grasping, a being able to be present with what is sufficient. Yeah? It's not just about pleasure. It's also about contentment. Now, contentment is not a static state of being either, but just to know it somewhat, because the person who is relatively content doesn't have to make anyone an enemy. The person who is relatively content also sees how dramatically and immediately their conduct affects other people and takes responsibility for it, which is all that is asked of you on this spiritual path, which is all that is asked of you on this path of maturation. Grow up. See the effect you have on other people. Take responsibility for it. Be a beacon wherever you can. Rabbi Herschel says, there is only one question worth asking. What am I here for? And it's really for knowing that you can be an instrument of wellness, happiness, and love. In all its variations, consolation, respect, inquiry, interest, patience, tolerance, all of these things that are hard to learn. So isn't it fantastic that we have so many opportunities and that we can learn them little step by little step? I'm so grateful for what I learned today from Donna, little step by little step. When my children were really little and intimacy and solitude was a big hit, and I was quite well known at the time. And sometimes I'd be in the supermarket and I'd think the children, my children were born a year apart, and I think they weren't behaving awfully well. And sometimes I was never very, very cross with them, because I was quite old when I had them, so I'd already learnt a lot of patience. But probably sometimes I might have been a bit sharp or whatever. I think, oh God, I'm supposed to have written intimacy and solitude. You know, we can berate ourselves for what we think we already know. It's in Forgiveness and Other Acts of Love where I write a long description of a woman going into a supermarket with one baby on the front and the other is the toddler, and she's trying to get something into the trolley, and she has several times to this attend to her little toddler who needs to have a wee. And every time she takes the toddler, of course, can't wee. And as she's wheeling this trolley around the supermarket, she sees one or two people whom she knew in that life that maybe she once lived. And she'd like to wave, but she doesn't have a spare hand. And all the time, Celine Dion is singing whatever it was, you know. What was that great big hit of hers? Yes, my heart will go on. You know, there are some situations that call for a great deal of patience. Yeah. And that we have to just notice our moments of sufficiency. And that little story, which has its autobiographical traces. I read it to my daughter recently, who's a mother herself now. And, you know, it finishes with that moment of them sitting in the car. And nobody has had a wee. All the stuff had to be left in the supermarket. But there is a moment of communion when they're just sitting there in the car having a cuddle before they drive home. This is life. We have many opportunities. Ah, this was asking me about a poem. Last night as I was sleeping, this poem I know, that was a question, I think not for the whole basket. How are we going for time, Hilary? Ah. 20 minutes. Yes, do you need to have a bit of a stand up and a wriggle? You're all right.
Anytime you say that, everybody say yes.
Okay, that's good, Sue. And John. I always have to say that, and then a few seconds later, no, that's all fine.